The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
It's time for the opposition to mobilize. So what is Trump's next move? With regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, whose land is it anyway? And Congresswoman Kat Kamick joins me to talk about who's enabling the human smugglers. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
As the Biden administration moves into high gear to try to push through all its proposals, a lot of bad stuff coming down the pike. It's really important for the opposition, for us, to move into high gear on our side. Not just to block and tackle, we need to do that, but also to think about strategically about our moves down the road. They say that an army is only as good as its generals, and we certainly know this to be true from the history of war. Think, for example, about how the Union armies were hampered in the beginning. They had lousy generals like McClellan that didn't want to engage, didn't know how to engage, basically waited and waited and waited some more. It wasn't until Lincoln got Grant and Sherman that the whole operation began to change and become much more effective. Now, the leading general on the Republican side, on the conservative side, is obviously Trump. And we have a general who is under the gun because there is all kinds of efforts on the part of the left to immobilize this guy. It's remarkable to see how open they are about it. They'll talk on NPR about the fact that, oh, wow, if we let Trump back on social media, this could help him if he runs again. So they're making it really clear that digital media is a weapon to prevent Trump from returning to power in any form. And then, of course, there are all the efforts led by the Southern District of New York. This is the outfit that prosecuted me to go after Trump, to get him on something. And it's very clear this is kind of a fishing expedition. Let's go raid Giuliani's office. Let's go search the computers. They've even sort of notified the people in Palm Beach that they need to be ready so that if they attempt to go after Trump, to arrest Trump, they would need to figure out how to do that. So this is a man who is marked by the other side. And it might be tempting in this phase for Trump to want to pull back, to say, well, you know what, I'll just play golf, I'll step out of it. But that's not Trump, fortunately. It's also important for us to realize that the best defense is a good offense, to think about the best moves to counter the other side where it matters, to make the correct move, not just to be active, but to be active in the right way. So I want to take up the question of what Trump is doing and what Trump should do. Now, what Trump is doing, quite clearly, is Trump has become sort of the key power broker in the Republican Party. It's almost an interesting scene to see these would-be candidates making their way down to Mar-a-Lago to sort of get Trump's blessing before they enter the race, because that could often be the decisive factor. It's not even the organizational skills. It's not even the amount of money you can raise. It's whether or not Trump gives you the green light. So Trump clearly is the mover and shaker in the Republican Party. And by being that, he is reshaping the party. He's remaking the Republican Party in a Trumpian mode. And it's becoming, you may say, a full-on MAGA party. the expulsion of Liz Cheney from the leadership position was symbolic of that. And this is actually what enraged the left the most. It wasn't even about Liz Cheney. They don't care about Liz Cheney. But it was, they realized that what this means is that this is no longer the party of Bush, that the Bush-Cheney era is something that Republicans want to get beyond and put behind them and kind of never go back to. And that Trump has laid out the path for the party going forward. So that's an important thing that Trump is doing. Now, Trump has also been talking about doing a super PAC. And this would be an effort to directly involve Trump in the races in 2022. And of course, in whatever capacity he chooses in 2024, either him running or him trying to be the power broker and discerning who should be the candidate. So the super PAC would be the practical mechanism for providing funding and logistical support and political support and advertising and all the various things that politics requires in order to carry itself out. There's also been talk and about Trump launching his own social media platform. I can totally understand why Trump would want to do that. Trump lived on social media. He loved it. I mean, it was really almost touching to see how Trump would tweet late in the night, early in the mornings. You know, this is a guy who enjoyed social media was part of his public identity. And then it was sort of taken away from him in a ridiculous way. And still, you've got these preening digital moguls who I think are secretly very proud of what they've accomplished, inflicting a real wound on Trump, not just a political wound, but I would say also a psychological wound. So you can see why Trump would be determined to have his own voice, to have his own platform. But it seems to me that this is only important to do if the other digital platforms don't get their act together. But if we get a fully functioning redesigned Parler up on the App Store, and if we have an effective Frank launched by Mike Lindell, and if we've got Rumble for videos, then we actually do have mechanisms that have been a little bit slow to get into full operation, but nevertheless can be very, very helpful down the road. Trump doesn't, in that case, need his own platform. He just needs to become active on these platforms and use the platforms that already exist. Now, there is one thing that does not exist that we do need, and I think we need quite desperately, and it also puts Trump. Trump is the guy in a unique position to be able to do this. And that is, we need a national network. I don't just mean a talk radio network. I don't just mean a politics 24 hours a day network. I don't actually mean another Fox. What I mean rather is something more like ABC or CBS. Networks that penetrate to tens of millions of households. A network that has the full lifestyle gamut of programming. So it has politics, but it also has shows that are the equivalent of The View, kind of conversational shows, shows that appeal to the younger generation, stand-up comedy, movies, late-night shows, and perhaps reality shows, soaps, the whole deal. In other words, a network that people can sort of live in. It's a little difficult to be on a network where you hear the same thing again and again and again and again and then again. You want a network that caters to the variety of not only demographic groups, but also the variety of human interests. The desire, for example, for stuff about religion and stuff about lifestyle and stuff about saving money. And now Trump can do this. Why? He has the brand. In other words, he has the name. He has the money. And he also has the contacts of other people who could put in money. They would trust him. Other investors would trust Trump to do this. Trump also has the pop culture exposure. He's a guy who's been on TV. He knows how to do it. And finally, he has the ready-made audience. He not only has the 70 million plus people who voted for him, but his collective followings on social media were huge. So the market is like waiting for Trump to do this. And so in a sense, I'm playing advisor to Trump, not in the sense that I'm whispering into his ear, but I'm sort of shouting it out loud so he can hear and others around him can hear that this would be an incredible thing to do, not instead of the stuff that he's doing, But in addition to it, it would put him right back into the game. It would give conservatives something that we've needed for a long time, something that, by the way, would outlast Trump, which is our own voice piped directly into the American home without the refracting, corrupting, and distorted filter of the media. The fundamental question in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is, whose land is it anyway? It's very easy when you have these clashes to get caught up in the minutia of it. Hamas fired a rocket and Israel attacked this Hamas leader. But that's fundamentally not what it's about. What it's about is two competing claims to the same land. And I want to sort of probe this question in its primary or primal significance. Now, very interestingly, when we talk about America, the settling of America, people often talk about the white man as the occupier. The white man came in and took the land from the Indians. The assumption here is that the Indians had some sort of a property right in the land. Now, obviously, the Indians didn't know about property rights. There's no, as far as I'm aware, American Indian John Locke to spell out a theory of property rights. So the simple notion here is that the Indians owned the land because they got here first, that they have the title deeds, morally speaking, to the land because they were the original inhabitants. Well, by exactly the same logic, the Jews were the original inhabitants of Israel, of Greater Israel. In fact, from the Old Testament, it was stated that God, in a sense, gave them that land. But whether or not you accept that, the religious significance of it, the simple fact of it is the Jews were there before the Palestinians. It was their land. Now, with regard to the American Indians, they were displaced. They were pushed further west and further south. This was the alleged dispossession of the American Indians. So the American Indians didn't vacate the land voluntarily. It was sort of taken from them. Well, by, again, exactly the same logic, the Jews were pushed out of Israel. By who? By the Romans. The Romans persecuted the Jews, and when they destroyed the temple, I believe in 70 AD, the Jews were scattered. They were sent to the far-flung corners of the world. It was the beginning of the Jewish diaspora. Now, let's pivot and talk about the Palestinians. The word Palestinian comes from the Greek word Philistia, referring to the Philistines. The Philistines are actually described in the Bible, Samson against the Philistines. And that was a region in the world, Palestine. There was never a state called Palestine, but the Palestinian people, who were basically the farmers and herders who moved in when the Jews were pushed away, these people were ruled by one conquering power after another. They were ruled originally, though that land was occupied by the Assyrians and the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans, then a whole bunch of Muslim invaders, the Arabs, the Fatimid sultans, the Seljuk Turks, the Crusaders, the Egyptians, the Mamluks. So this is one ruling power over another taking control of that land. Now, for centuries, basically from the 16th century to the early 20th century, the Ottoman Empire, which was the greatest of all empires, ruled over that region. But the Ottoman Empire became decapitated. It collapsed after World War I. And then the region called Palestine was controlled by the British. And the British, in 1947, worked with the newly formed United Nations. This is right after World War II. With a plan to partition Palestine, or the region called Palestine, into two regions, an independent Jewish state and an independent Arab state. Now, they knew there was a big fight over Jerusalem, and so what they said is Jerusalem will belong to neither. It will be an international city. It will be under sort of special charter. Now, the Jewish leaders went, okay, we accept the deal, but the Palestinians said no. They refused, and they began to mobilize an army to fight against this. And this was the root of the 1948 war, the war over the formation of Israel itself, in which you had a mobilization of a whole bunch of Muslim countries, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, all together against the newly formed state of Israel. Unbelievably, Israel won that war. it's almost, you'd have to say, a secular miracle that little Israel was able to pistol whip all these Muslim countries working together. And now we have to fast forward from 1948 to 1967, because at the end of the 48 war, Jordan controlled the West Bank and Egypt controlled the Gaza Strip. But in the 67 war, you basically had a sort of second mobilization. The 67 war began with a war between Israel and Syria, but later Nasser brought Egypt into the war, and pretty soon it drew in Jordan, it drew in Syria. And so this is the so-called Six-Day War. Israel won again. This is sort of a second miracle, a second pistol whipping of the same kind of coalition. And this time Israel got the Golan Heights, they got the West Bank, they got the Gaza Strip. Now they made a deal with Egypt, they gave back the Golan Heights, but Israel to this day controls the West Bank and controls Gaza. And that's the region that is now occupied by Palestinians. That's the region now ruled. The West Bank is ruled by the Palestinian Authority, which traces itself to the PLO, the old Palestine Liberation Organization run by Yasser Arafat. And the Gaza Strip is controlled and has been controlled now for some years by Hamas. So we have here a sort of an argument. The Jews say, we were here first. The Palestinians say, yeah, but when you left, and it was a long time ago, we sort of moved in and created a Palestinian state. To which the Jews reply, no, you didn't. There never was a Palestinian state. There were people grazing and shepherding and hunting on this land, but there never was, in fact, a state. The concept of an existing Palestinian state is a kind of fiction. This was a sort of a no man's land. And then we, the Jews, came back, starting in the late 19th century, but continuing in the 20th century. We bought land, we settled, we moved in. We have the same right to occupy this land that you did. You just wandered over here, and so we wandered here too. And so what you have are these rival claims, and I suppose at the end of the day, it's impossible to definitively say who's right. But what I do want to say is that this notion that the Palestinians own the land, the Israelis are occupiers, the Israelis are colonialists, they've dispossessed the Palestinians, all of that is highly one-sided, tendentious, partisan, ideological rhetoric. At the very best, you'd have to say that there are legitimate competing claims on the part of the Jews based on original occupation, perhaps on the basis of biblical sanction, perhaps also on the basis of the very simple fact that when the land was supposed to be partitioned, you fought us. You tried to fight for this land. We fought a war. You lost. That's that. That's about as good a claim as any historically. In fact, most of the boundaries on the entire planet have been established that way. Through conquest, through a fight in which one side lost and then belly aches and goes, yeah, but we have a moral right. Well, yeah, but you tried to vindicate that right on the battlefield and you got pulverized. Now, I'm not saying that this is a justification for not giving the Palestinians citizenship or rights or any of that. All of that is a separate issue. But the idea that this is not Israeli land, the idea that the Palestinians really own it and that Israel is a colonial power, that I think is established certainly on the basis of history, but also on the basis of morality, to be a progressive leftist fiction. I want to talk to you about MyPillow and how it changed Debbie's sleeping habits. Well, the culprit is here in the room, so I figured I'd have her tell you herself.
Oh,
come,
wow.
Come talk. Let him know.
I don't even have lipstick on. Yeah. So when I started sleeping on Mike's pillow, I began to sleep through the night. I have had insomnia for the last, I don't even know how long, a long time. I tried everything and nothing worked until I slept on this awesome pillow. I also have a body pillow, which is like super big. And it almost kicks them off the bed.
Well, so, the cool thing about these pillows, they won't go flat. You can wash and dry them as often as you want. They maintain their shape. They're made in the USA. For a limited time, Mike Lindell is offering his premium MyPillows for the lowest price ever. You can get a queen-size premium MyPillow for $29.98, normally $69.98, so that's a $40 savings. The King Pillow is only $5 more. All the MyPillow products come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee. You do the rest.
Oh, yeah. So go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use the code Dinesh. You'll also get deep discounts on everything else, but don't forget, go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-876-0227. And don't forget to use promo code Dinesh. I promise he won't sing again.
You might have noticed that the news, the media in America and in the West covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, this news reporting is, well, let's just say one-sided. It's just as one-sided, just as partisan as the news coverage inside of America. And the question is, how does this fake news get made? What is the sort of sausage-making process of creating this news? Let's start with an interesting sort of puzzle. And that is that you've got multiple news organizations, AP, you've got all the New York Times, you've got the Boston Globe, all this coverage. It's all occurring from different news organizations. And yet it all reads exactly the same words, the same cliches, the same headlines. It's almost as if the same guy wrote all of it. So what you're dealing with here quite clearly is a very homogenous, and I would say incestuous, politically incestuous group of people who think alike, live alike, see the world alike, have a sort of narrow lens, but it's the only lens because these are the people who deliver the news. Interestingly, when Israel bombed the AP building in Gaza, the head of AP, made this pompous proclamation, the world will now be deprived of the news of what's happening in Gaza. And I'm thinking to myself, the world, first of all, the world is being deprived of Palestinian propaganda produced by AP, but not just by AP, because AP, in a sense, reflects the way that the news is covered more generally. Now, very interestingly, we have from 2014, a few years ago, an article by a fellow named Matty Friedman, who was both a reporter and editor in the Jerusalem Bureau of, you guessed it, AP, the Associated Press. And this guy got to see close up the sausage-making machine, how the news gets made. And he has some very interesting observations. The first thing he says is that the news community in a foreign country, let's say in Gaza, for example, they don't know how to function over there. They can't get around. They need people to show them around. So in other words, they need an infrastructure which is then provided by the Palestinians, by groups like Hamas. Hamas goes, hey, listen, come to the same building. Why don't you run an office right next to our office? We'll show you around. The Hamas people have gotten very cunning and they've realized that what they can do is manipulate the news media, but manipulate not in the sense that they are conning the Western news media, but rather they are enabling the Western news media to become propaganda vehicles for Hamas. So just as the news media in America is a propaganda vehicle for the Democratic Party, you could say that in Gaza, they've become propaganda vehicles for Hamas. Now, Hamas is willing to use carrots and sticks. By carrots, what I mean is, yes, we'll tell, here's a great story. A five-year-old was just injured. There's blood on his face. Let's go over to this street. We'll take you over there. We'll protect you along the way. But we expect that you will cover the story from our point of view. And in fact, even more important, and this is something Matty Friedman points out, that you will not reveal that you are basically in our care. You will not reveal that we are the ones providing you with the news. We're writing, you may say, the raw material of your press release. You're delivering the news that we want you to deliver as a condition for us showing you this five-year-old boy. The other thing that Hamas does is threaten. So when there are reporters, and there aren't too many of them, that go, well, wait a minute, aren't I supposed to call it like I see it? Aren't I supposed to do an independent perspective? This kind of person today is quite rare. But let's say you do find one. Hamas basically raids the offices. They show up with guns. They wave the guns around. They threaten that they will no longer provide any kind of protection. Hey, you're on your own. If somebody shoots you, and maybe one of us, that's something, that's a risk you take. You're in a dangerous part of the world. So, says Matty Friedman, not only are reporters under this pressure, you may say this is the stick that goes with the carrot, but again, they never reveal it. They never say to their readers or to their listeners, hey, listen, you know, you've got these Hamas thugs and they've got bandanas and they've got machine guns, and we are constantly living under the intimidation that is produced by that. And therefore, our reporting should be understood in that light. We're not just standing, you know, in front of the Empire State Building telling the news. We've got people around us, and you may almost say a rhetorical, in some cases literal, gun to our head as we report. But we're going to tell you nothing about this. We're going to pretend like the news itself is not part of the news. Very often, Hamas will orchestrate an attack. They will basically move civilians into an area that they know is a target of Israeli attack. Why? Because they want the civilians to be hit. That's their objective. And then the news media has been alerted, and they're literally waiting around for the hit. They're waiting for the bomb to fall so that they can all take pictures. And they're all, it's almost like a staged event. Now, again, the point here is the media is in on it. They're part of the staging of the event. Why? Because they recognize what Hamas is doing. But again, they never say that. They never reveal, hey, Hamas brought us here. They told us there's an Israeli hit that's going to come on this territory. They have moved civilians into the area prior to the hit so that they can get pictures. This whole event exists for the media. But the one thing is, the American people, or let's just say the people of the world, will never be let into this little secret, because it's a trade secret. It's something that you might say the news industry decided it's better off keeping to itself. Why? Because to reveal it is to reveal that these news people aren't really news people. They aren't really reporters in the ordinary sense of the term. They're propagandists, some of them placed in a difficult situation, but all of them responding to carrots and sticks, all of which have the effect of telling one side of the story that purports and pretends to be the whole story. Debbie and I have gotten to know Dr. Douglas Howard, who founded the company Balance of Nature. What a remarkable guy. He convinced us that we are not eating enough fruits and veggies, even though we thought we were. Now, you don't need to eat the stuff you don't like. Turn to the Balance of Nature solution instead. Can you imagine how you'd feel if you were eating 10 servings of fruits and veggies every single day?
So I started first, and it's amazing. And then I got him to do it. And let me tell you, getting him to do anything is a little difficult. He's a little bit stubborn, but we take 6 daily capsules and we're set. We get all the vital nutrients sourced from 31 fruits and veggies every single day. I also love the fiber and spice powder. It's never kept me more regular.
Join us and experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code AMERICA. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code AMERICA. I'm really delighted to welcome to the podcast Congresswoman Kat Kamick from Florida. Kat, thanks for coming on the program. I want to talk to you about the border and some of your remarkable experiences there. But before we do that, you're a new member of Congress from Gainesville, Florida. You've been in for a few months. What is kind of your original take on this new job and what it's like?
Well, first, thanks for having me on the show, Dinesh. Awesome to see you. And yes, proud to represent the Gator Nation. Of course, you know, I think by law, I'm required to do that. a gator chomp. But no, the first 5 months, it's been kind of a crap show, to be honest. Right out the gate, it's a combination of really the gridlock that we're experiencing, the dysfunctional, non-existent leadership of Speaker Pelosi. It is really the ultra liberal left agenda that's being rammed down our throats every day. It is the changing of the schedule to try to throw members off. It's a combination of things. It's all been quite a mess. And then of course you factor in all of the challenges that we're facing domestically, the crisis at the Southwest border, abroad, the attacks on Israel, our economy falling to pieces. It's pretty overwhelming, if I'm being honest, but at the end of the day, as I walk through the halls of Congress, I am reminded that I am walking in the same halls that the greats did. And it is truly an honor and privilege to serve my hometown and my friends, family and neighbors and constituents in North Central Florida. So while it's easy to be discouraged, I take heart knowing that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of patriotic, freedom, liberty-loving people all around America that have got my back. So it's all good.
Would you say that the challenge for the Republican Party is to do block and tackle for 2 years and expose the agenda of the Biden administration so the American people wake up and go, hey, this is I may have voted for this, but this is not what I bargained for. Then with the expectation that people would have a change of power come 2022. Is that our strategy, or is there something different that, and are the Republicans united in wanting to execute that strategy?
Yeah. You know, I tell people, despite what you see on the news, we are one team, one mission. And that mission is to take back the House, because this is a majority run institution. And let's be honest, the Speaker of the House controls everything from what gets voted on, what gets put on the agenda, to how the very basics of the House, down to the forks and spoons and knives in the cafeteria. You know, I mean, it's everything. So it is more important than ever that we take back the House. And in the meantime, conservatives, our job is to, one, just take bullets. We have to stand in defense of our Constitution and our districts and our country, and really expose the hypocrisy of the left. This is truly turned into the House of Hypocrites rather than the House of Representatives, because as we've seen firsthand, you know, Nancy Pelosi, she loves walls, but only when they're around the Capitol, but not at our Southwest border. And they want to do everything they can to take our Second Amendment away and strip Americans and law-abiding citizens of their right to bear arms. Yet they want people to protect them with guns. So it's a matter of staying united, showing the American people exactly what this very dangerous ultra-liberal left agenda looks like. And we're seeing it play out in front of our eyes. I talked with a couple of Democrat restaurateurs the other day, and they said, I voted for Biden. I've never voted Republican in my life, but I can't find help anywhere. I'm about to lose my business. I need help. And so they're starting to wake up, and it's our job to continue to expose that and support what we all want. A free constitutional republic where the people have the decisions and the ability to make decisions for themselves and their families, not the other way around.
Now, Kat, you were at the southern border. You were in Brownsville, Texas, and you made a very interesting discovery that had to do with the role of Facebook. And you talk about the fact that you spoke to Border Patrol officers and you also spoke to migrants. And what did they tell you about the role of Facebook in enabling these illegal border crossings?
You know, Dinesh, I'm going to be going back to the border, and I'd love to have you come with me at some point, because it's mind blowing. I hadn't been on the ground but 5 minutes, and we walked up to a bus that was unloading a group that had been picked up out in the fields as they'd crossed the border. And a 16-year-old from Honduras had said, I'm here. I have my son. And I asked her, how did you know to come here? Like, how did you get the logistics and the payment and coordinate with cartels? And she said, in one simple word, Facebook. And as I kept making my way through the processing facility, I kept hearing from kids as young as 12 years old, Facebook. They coordinated logistics through Facebook. They talked on the phone or messaged on WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook. There were ads that had been targeted to these folks in El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Guatemala, all over the place. They're getting targeted ads and private groups, and it's incredible. It tells you a price. It tells you the number to call. It tells you what to expect. And when I started looking myself on Facebook, thinking, hey, I'm 32 years old. I'm pretty savvy. I could figure this out. I started doing simple searches, you know, viaje a Estados Unidos, or, cruzando la frontera. And you find pages, you find advertisements, you find all kinds of ridiculous things that are promoting illegal activity that the cartels are paying Facebook to put these ads up. And they're just pushing this out left and right and center.
So you basically have illegal activity being plotted and being advertised on Facebook. And not only were you told about this, but you checked it out for yourself to make sure that this was in fact happening. You said that you keep finding new ads. And now you wrote a letter to Facebook, to Zuckerberg, basically pointing this out. And you attached examples of the kind of advertising that you were referring to. Have you heard back?
So what was interesting was when we mentioned this to Facebook, they received our letter. We had a phone call coming in immediately saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to check into this. We're going to check into this. At this point, we're working with them, but I'm not going to lie. I'm pretty frustrated with the fact that as a member of Congress, I can pull up a simple search on my phone and find advertisements. Yet Facebook, who has some of the best algorithms, according to them, in the world, they can't figure out why these ads keep coming up and why they're not violating their community standards during the review process. For any of us who have ever placed an ad on Facebook, you know that your ad has to go through an approval process and it gets run through all the community standards. So tell me why the single mom in my district in Ocala, Florida, who's a videographer who does weddings, she got censored and her ads rejected for violating community standards because she posted a picture wearing a MAGA hat. But then a cartel who posted an ad that says $9,300 and we'll get you to San Antonio. How is that not a violation of community standards? So there's something else that has come up here recently. You know, just last week, I had the ambassador of Honduras in my office and he asked me to please help them with taking on Facebook and WhatsApp because it's become the preferred method of communication with the narco terrorists in country for them. So it's not just a problem that we're seeing at the Southwest border. It's something that we're seeing in these countries, in the triangle countries, Central and South America. It's being used as a way to communicate and move money around and handle logistics for these cartels and these narco terrorists.
Is there a way, I'm trying to think outside the box here, but I mean, is there a way to report Facebook to the federal authorities? Because the Facebook is actually enabling criminal operations that are crossing not just state, but national lines. Facebook has been notified about them. They're pretending to do something, but they're not doing anything. I mean, wouldn't a call from the Justice Department get their attention?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why we're staying on top of this. You know, as a member of the Homeland Security Committee, I've been working with my colleagues and our ranking member, John Katko, to make sure that we're holding their feet to the fire on this. And, you know, it's not just Facebook and WhatsApp. It's also TikTok. You know, I myself have sat with Homeland Security investigations and watched TikTok videos where they have cartels showing the mocking of, you know, assassinations on our Border Patrol agents and recruiting drivers, recruiting people to help smuggle migrants coming across the border. It's disgusting. And we as lawmakers have got to get very serious about holding these companies' feet to the fire. They're complicit in the trafficking of children. And I'm telling you, after meeting some of these young girls as young as 9 who have been gang raped to the point where their vocal cords have given out from screaming, shame on Facebook, shame on WhatsApp, shame on these companies who virtue signal all the time over every single issue they can think of that's in vogue at the time, but they won't lift a finger to stop the trafficking of young, innocent girls. This is crazy. So we're going to stay on top of it. We'll be working with the Justice Department, but we're also going to continue working with Facebook and these companies to make sure that they're adjusting their community standards to clamp down on this.
Yeah, this is really awesome. I want to thank you for bringing this story to light. Sometimes when you're in the opposition, it seems like there's not a whole lot for you to do because, like you say, the other side controls the agenda. But you're showing there are a lot of things that you can do at the very least to bring these things to public light and maybe to hold some of these digital companies accountable. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Dinesh. Thanks for all that you do. Appreciate you.
The Biden administration is in big spending mode. They're talking about student debt forgiveness, more stimulus checks, expanded unemployment benefits, a $2 trillion infrastructure plan. Question comes to mind, what's the economic consequence? Who's going to pay for this? Clearly, these guys think they're playing with monopoly money. Now, for years, actually decades, I never invested in gold, just the stock market. But now I'm seriously worried about the regime we have in Washington. No sense of fiscal responsibility. And listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a ticking time bomb. Invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Birch Gold Group is who I purchase from and who you can trust to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. That's right, through a little known tax loophole, you can convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation. text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and countless five-star reviews, Birch Gold can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold and precious metals before it's too late. I want to talk about the left and the Biden administration's project of going after the rich, which I may be tempted to reflexively oppose. I'm against this. Don't do it. We defend the rich. The Republican Party has been the party that defends the rich. Well, that might have been the old Republican Party, but it's not the Republican Party today. The Republican Party is not for the rich. We're actually the party of the working class. And if the left wants to target the rich, at least the ones that voted for the Democrats, are kind of on their own. They're not people that we have any interest in defending. Now, Biden wants to go after certain types of rich people. He says, it's time for corporate America and the wealthiest 1% to pay their fair share. He wants to increase the top individual tax rate, double the capital gains rate, increase the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%. So do I care that Starbucks or Microsoft is going to be paying 28 instead of 21? I could care less. I wouldn't be unhappy if they paid 50. Why? Because I'm not interested in defending these people. These are people who are getting what they voted for. They put money into the Biden campaign, they are reaping a harvest that they sowed. Now, Senator Tom Cotton has come up with a really interesting idea, which is very along the lines of my way of thinking. He goes, instead of reflexively saying, this attack on the rich is horrible, he goes, wait a minute, guys, you want to go after the rich? What about the wealthy universities? What about all the wealthy foundations? What about all these wealthy organizations, many of them nonprofits, but they have accumulated vast reservoirs of wealth? Now, let's talk about those reservoirs. Let's start by talking about Harvard. Harvard has a gigantic endowment. And if you want to go after the rich, well, this is an excellent target. And we're not just talking about Harvard. Let's talk about charitable foundations together have more than $1 trillion of assets. The richest five alone have nearly $100 billion among them. This means America's charitable foundations and billionaire universities, their total assets, $1.5 trillion. By the way, that is more money than Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and the founders of Google and Oracle have combined. So this is a gigantic Fort Knox, you might say, of private wealth. And here's the thing. They hardly pay any taxes. While corporations pay 20, 21, 22% in taxes, these guys pay like 1%, 1.5%. Rich universities and grant-making foundations pay 1.4% in federal taxes on their net investment income. This is even a fraction of what people pay in capital gains. So the question then becomes, why do they have this massive tax subsidy? Now, of course, Harvard could say, well, we're doing very good things with the money. We're educating students and we're sponsoring research. Well, every corporation, every rich guy can say the same thing. Well, I'm investing in new forms of drilling, and well, I'm giving away a substantial amount of my money, and this enables me to do more if I'm taxed less. So this argument that I've got other good things to do with my money is not exactly unique to Harvard or to the Ford Foundation or to the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to impose a sort of wealth tax. This would be a tax, sort of a 3% annual tax on individuals who have assets of $1 billion or more. Great idea. Apply it to the foundations. Apply it to the universities. Why consider Harvard not to be a rich guy and tax Harvard according to the same logic? Interestingly, Senator Warren does not include institutions like Harvard in this wealth tax scheme. But if she did, if Harvard University, which has, by the way, an endowment of $39.4 billion. This is as of 2019. So more now, probably closer to $50 billion. Well, If you apply a 3% tax on a $50 billion endowment, that's $150 million annually. That'll build a lot of roads. That will create a lot of jobs. Now, Senator Cotton's proposal, this is Tom Cotton of Arkansas, is to impose a 1% tax on the value of endowments of the wealthiest private colleges and foundations. He also would require these foundations to draw down, meaning many times they don't even touch their endowment, but to draw down 5% of the value of their endowments each year. And he says, listen, we, with this money, with this 1% tax, the federal government can use that money to create high-paying working-class jobs. Now, think about it. This would be equitable in the sense that the industrial sector of America has been decimated. Working-class people have been taking a hit for something for nearly 40 years. And these universities have flourished. They have gotten more and more money. A lot of that money, by the way, coming from the federal government. The federal government provides grants. Universities keep raising their prices, even though inflation has been 1 or 2%. The university increases their prices 10%. So these people have been running an unbelievable racket. And it's time to take some of this energy, based upon let's go and get the people to pay their fair share, and ask what is the fair share that these universities and foundations, by the way, most of them inclining to the left, most of them in cahoots with the Democratic Party. We can kind of see why the Democratic Party wants to exempt them from having to pay. But we Republicans shouldn't be suckers. We should recognize that these people are ideologically on the other side. They're using their resources to undermine us. And so the more we can do to target them, to attack them, to fault them using the very rhetoric that they use. What is their fair share? Let's apply this logic to them. This, it seems to me, offers some real campaign possibilities for 2022 and 2024. Tax the rich, yes, but let's go after these characters who have essentially gotten away paying hardly any taxes at all. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you must try Genesis 950. The reviews are incredible. This is one product that actually works. With water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950 is made in America. 1 gallon of industrial strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, floors, upholstery, grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the kitchen. And I have a tendency to put chocolate on all kinds of stuff on my pants, on the couch. But Genesis 950 takes it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com. To receive a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon only available for 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950. It's much cheaper than replacing your carpets or your pants or your couch. A pastor friend of mine had kind of a funny saying. He would say to me periodically, "Hey, Dinesh, what do you think the devil is up to right about now?" Kind of an arresting question, because if you believe in the devil, as I do, and you believe the devil is active in the world, it's kind of interesting to think, what's the devil's current project? So I try to sort of keep track of the devil, but I also try to keep track of Obama, because I like to know what Obama's up to. What's Obama doing right about now? And I have 2 Obama updates for this segment, both of which I think are interesting in different ways. The first one is that this is news out of Kenya. I'm reading a headline, kind of makes me chuckle. Obama family appeals for financial aid to airlift Kin's body to Kenya for burial. So it turns out that the first wife of Barack Obama Sr., so this is Obama's stepmom, the first wife of Barack Obama Sr. was a woman named Kezia Obama, and she just died at the age of 78. And think how remarkable this is. Her family doesn't have the money to bury her. And so they're asking the Kenyan people to contribute. They've set up a sort of a hotline, and they go, "We are bringing Mama Kezia home to rest, grateful for donations." They've also appealed for aid to the Kenyan government. Now, let's think about this. They are related, closely related, to one of the richest people in America. Somebody who made a $50 million contract with Netflix alone. Someone who's raking in money through speeches left and right. Someone who could help, but evidently has no interest in helping. So the very man who pranced around the country years ago, "We are a brother's keeper," has no interest in helping his own family. Admittedly, his extended family. I'm not saying that he's got a sort of a legal obligation here. But anyone who's successful anywhere in the world generally becomes the automatic, well, bank of needy relatives. And sometimes when the need is real, particularly such simple things as, you know, as someone died, they need money for burial. Usually those things are not begrudged. But clearly these people know they can't count on Obama because they know he's that type of a guy. Asking Obama for money, I mean, you may as well send a bill to Lucifer. It's going to come back returned. You're not going to get any help from that quarter. That's not Lucifer's agenda. Well, it's not Obama's either. Now, on another amusing note, I see coming to America a school in Waukegan, Illinois, which was going to be named the Barack Obama School, has decided to cancel Obama. This is great. The canceller canceled. This is Thomas Jefferson Middle School. Now, notice, by the way, that to be politically correct, they decide, or the school board decides, we can't have the name Thomas Jefferson. So that's mistake number one. Thomas Jefferson, of course, a far greater man than anyone the school could be named after now. But evidently, they were considering naming him after Obama. And the wonderful thing is, a bunch of Hispanics, Latinos, came out and said, we're not having it. We don't like Obama. Why? Because he was the deporter in chief. That's actually their phrase. He was the biggest deporter of undocumented aliens. And so Obama may be sort of the black man par excellence, but he's not the Latino man par excellence. We're going to kick him out to the curb. No Obama for us. I'm now quoting one guy goes, I will not be part of renaming a school after someone who did not and does not represent the undocumented community. So evidently he wants to go from Jefferson to someone who represents the undocumented community. You know, maybe some coyote who got them over the border. It's now called Coyote Middle School. It fully represents the undocumented community because without the coyotes, it never got here in the first place. Well, apparently I learned from the article something I didn't know in terms of numbers. Trump evidently deported 935,000 people in 4 years, but Obama deported 5 million in 8. So although Obama was there longer, if you do the math, you'll see that Obama's deportation rate considerably higher than Trump. Trump averages about 200,000 deportations a year. Obama, not quite a million, but more something more like 600,000 or 700,000. So he was indeed the deporter in chief. And it's kind of, I suppose, a certain type of karmic justice that this has now come back to haunt him. Mike Lindell has come out with the world's most comfortable bed sheets. He found the best cotton in the world in a place where the Sahara Desert, the Nile, and the Mediterranean Sea all come together to create the ideal weather conditions for growing cotton. His new Giza Dream bed sheets are made with this long staple cotton, and they are the most comfortable sheets you'll ever own. The first night you sleep on them, you're never going to want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream sheets are available in a variety of colors. Like all of Mike's products, they come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Right now, buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. Again, for a limited time, buy one, get one free. Call 800-876-0227 or just go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. Prince Harry is back in the news, and this time he is commenting on the First Amendment. Yeah, the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights. We're talking about that First Amendment, part of the U.S. Constitution. Prince Harry said that after doing some reflection and cogitation about the First Amendment, he's concluded in one word that it is bonkers. Yeah, bonkers. He just doesn't see the point of it. He doesn't get it. This idea of people having free speech, this idea of limiting the ability of the government to regulate and control speech, it makes absolutely no sense to Prince Harry. Now, the context for all this is that Harry has been evidently placed on a commission By the Aspen Institute. The Aspen Institute is a think tank similar to the Brookings Institution or AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, where I worked. And these think tanks at one time used to be serious academic and research institutions. They would have scholars, very often scholars of world famous note. At the Hoover Institution, for example, I was with people like Milton Friedman and George Shultz at AEI, with people like Judge Bork, Irving Kristol, Michael Novak. But these think tanks have now sort of deteriorated. They've become a joke. And they what they do is they'll grab a celebrity over here. Michelle Obama is now going to issue a paper. And this Hollywood star is now going to chair a commission. And evidently they've put Harry on a commission. Now, if they asked me, I would say, well, yeah, I mean, do you have a commission on beta males? Because, you know, this guy would fit right in. I mean, you can then just call up, you know, Justin Trudeau and... there are going to be others that will fit right in. But evidently, they chose to put him on a commission on information disorder. Sounds like some sort of ailment, commission on information disorder. I'm suffering from information disorder syndrome. He's apparently charged with analyzing. I don't think the concept of analyzing and Harry really kind of go together. But nevertheless, the spread of incorrect information. And now here's Harry speaking to this new appointment. I love the beginning. As I've said, he's quoting himself, to refer to my own previous remarks. I always love this. Politicians do this all the time. As I said in my own earlier speech on this matter, his own earlier speech is the best thing he could find on the subject. As I've said, the experience of today's digital world has us inundated with an avalanche of misinformation, affecting our ability as individuals as well as societies to think clearly and truly understand the world we live in. Evidently, this kid who, you know, grew up in a castle thinks that he has it. He can understand the world, but he's really worried that other people might be led astray by this avalanche of misinformation. Now, what's really going on here? I don't think we need to sort of analyze Harry's views about the First Amendment. What we need to say about it is this. Harry, probably sort of prodded by Meghan Markle, I don't know if you've seen those scenes on social media where Harry's kind of diffident and Meghan Markle is pushing him. Harry, introduce me to this guy. Get me in this movie. So Meghan Markle seems to be the one who's kind of wearing the pants. You know, Harry has the beard, but Meghan wears the pants. And Harry is now in this kind of cultural celebrity mode, which means that he doesn't have thoughts, but he echoes the zeitgeist of the culture. And this is what is so telling. When Harry says he doesn't really get the First Amendment, what he's really saying is that the cultural left in America doesn't get the First Amendment. They don't see why people should have genuine free speech. They don't see why the government shouldn't step in and regulate speech. And of course, we now see Democratic congressmen, leftist pundits, calling for more regulation of speech. So Harry here is almost like a kind of cultural parrot, repeating what he hears around him. And what's useful about his idiocies and their sheer idiocies is that they are a reflection of the idiocy of his ambient circle. So that's what's going on. You'll hear Harry talking about things like climate change. Now, this guy, you know, who lives in a climate-controlled building, doesn't know or care whether the world is getting hotter or colder. He doesn't know. But what he says on the subject is telling because it tells you what the people around him say. It tells you what Meghan Markle says. So we can look at Harry's comments here as kind of the... just in the way that we think of a ventriloquist doll. A ventriloquist doll doesn't speak for itself, but it reflects what other people really think and say. And in that sense, the world's leading beta male has done another ventriloquist performance from which we can learn not about him, not about his mind. There's not a whole lot there, but the minds of the people in his circle. You know, with the Middle East in flames, with all the influence of radical Islam in America, I keep thinking to myself, wow, it's all in the movie. And by movie, I mean this one right here, Trump Card. We released the movie late last year, but it couldn't be more relevant now. It was based on my book called United States of Socialism. Here's a short clip from the movie that gives you a feel of the kind of stuff the movie talks about. Listen.
What is the fundamentalist and jihadi agenda for America?
The future of America has to be Muslim.
What you're saying is that there is serious Middle Eastern and specifically radical Islamic intervention into U.S. politics.
Exactly. And I think it's more dangerous than the so-called Russian collusion.
This is basically like a roadmap through hell. It's something you need to know about. Here's how you can get the Trump Card DVDs at an incredible bargain price of $9.99. You got to get one for yourself and get others as gifts. Here's how you do it. Go to SalemNowStore.com. That's S-A-L-E-M, SalemNowStore.com, and order the DVDs right away. It's now time for our mailbox. And let's go to today's question. Listen.
Hi, Dinesh. Marty in Pennsylvania here, USA. My question to you is rather personal. I was wondering, what are the three main things that you're most proud of that you've done with your life or in your life? And to let you know that I really enjoy listening to Debbie Loff off screen, and also when the two of you are together, the amount of love and respect I see that you have for each other is really quite wonderful. Thank you so much for your podcast. It really gets me thinking and exploring more items further. God bless and take care.
What an interesting question, and so different than the questions I normally get about my ideas or my work. And I'm really glad you chuckle about Debbie. I love having her as my producer in the studio and on the show. And of course, an active part of our movies. And she's brought incredible joy to my life. I mean, I find that if you have the right marriage partner, that's probably the single greatest key to your daily happiness. It's funny, I met Debbie because she had sent me some videos with Bill Ayers in Venezuela, and I contacted her, but I didn't really bring that up. And later she goes, well, you kind of showed very little interest, at least initial interest, in Venezuela. And I go, well, yeah, that's because I was interested in the Venezuelan, not so much in Venezuela, at least initially. I'm also immensely proud of my daughter because raising a kid, at least in our environment, very difficult. It's actually easier to do in India, where the society conspires with you, with the parents, to raise children. And children often turn out a lot like their parents. But that's not normal in America, where we send our kids off to college, they get propagandized, they get beaten down. I'm very thrilled about the way that my daughter has developed, and we have very close relationships. So being happy as a husband, as a parent, those are two of the most, I would count them as successes on a personal scale in my life. And maybe the third one, also a key, by the way, to my happiness, coming to America. I took the plunge when I was 17 years old, and there are some people who think, and probably the way most Indians and most people come to America is they come as a family. But in my case, I didn't do that. I came alone as an exchange student. Now, when I first came, I didn't know that I would never go back. I was sort of coming to stay. But that was a big step for me to take that decision over time, to make this my new country with my family back thousands of miles away in India. And there is a cost to that because, of course, it detached me from having that kind of everyday relationship with my family. And I missed out on years with my dad and mom as a consequence of all this. But also America has been a place where I've been able to experience things and do things and become things and make movies. I've been able to do things with my life that I know would have been impossible, not just in India, but pretty much anywhere else in the world. So when I think, as I look at my life, and I just turned 60 last month, I count my happiness as a husband, my happiness as a father, and my happiness in America as three of my accomplishments that fill me with the greatest joy and gratitude.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify.